My name is Anthony Morgan. I'm from the National Institute for Health and Clinical Excellence, and today I'm going to be talking about the asset model to try and encourage policymakers, practitioners, and researchers to think and act differently about the types of things that can be protective for health throughout the life course. Thanks very much for the introduction, Harry. And I've already done this presentation once today. And one of the things that I thought was very useful about the presentation, it was to a much smaller group, but we were able to have a conversation and a dialogue. So I didn't go through the hundreds of slides that you're going to have to sit through at the end of the day, although I'll tell you a little bit more about that in a minute. Because actually, in terms of thinking about an asset approach to public health, we need to start doing more listening rather than talking. And I'm talking about professionals with local communities, but also within a professional context. I actually want to listen to what you have to say about your thoughts on what these sorts of things mean to you, but also how you've been doing them, perhaps not by the name, in your own work. So I am going to try and find opportunities to have a little break throughout the presentation. And I might even skip some slides, but the full set of slides will be available after the seminar. But can I just ask you, just to give me an idea who you are, because I will be making reference to these categories of people soon, how many sort of policymakers do we have in the room? People classify themselves as policymakers. We've got fewer of those. Classify yourself as practitioners? And researchers? So equal spread amongst those people. And I think it's important because one of the things that I will be talking about is actually us working together within our different perspectives and how sometimes that can be a barrier to assets-based working. But I think what I want to do, there's a lot of information in the presentation, but I just want to share my own experience of working with this idea. And it is an idea, and it's a set of ideas that can help us, as my title suggests, think and act differently. But it does need a change in mindset. As Harry said, I've been working for 28 years in the health service, but probably most of that time I've been working at a national level in different organisations that were institutes of public health. I don't know how long you people have been around, but I worked for the Health Education Authority and the Health Development Agency until about 5 years ago when the Health Development Agency was subsumed into NICE. In fact, to our horror, we weren't sure what that was going to hold for public health as an entity. Actually, it's worked out actually extremely well. Clearly, though, there are some downsides. But early on in my career in the Health Education Authority, I conducted commissioned a large programme of research on social capital and its potential to have health benefit. And we commissioned a range of projects, both quantitative projects, looking at the links between social capital and a range of different health outcomes, qualitative projects to try and understand how social capital might relate to different age groups, to gender, to different population groups. And a third tranche of project, which is most closely related to the idea of assets-based working, is a programme of work called the Social Action for Health and Wellbeing. And it's this time that's planted the seed of my interest in actually thinking about how we develop a better evidence base for these types of approaches. Because there's lots of practice going on, but less gets on the table of the committees who are responsible for producing NICE guidance to try and get them to understand how they might make recommendations to improve standards across the board about how we do these sorts of things. I'm also going to be talking about the opportunities for having diverse experiences, and I've been lucky to have opportunities, and one of the luckiest opportunities I had was to go and work in WHO for 4 months in Venice, working with a friend and colleague, Erio Ziglia. And it was Erio who first started to talk to me about the idea of assets My language at that time had been very much around social capital, but there were I could see some connections, and I went there to think about how we might progress the idea so it became more mainstream in public health policy research and practice. And the last bit of the jigsaw in terms of my own personal experience is the bottommost picture that you can see there, and it's a picture of a flamenco club in Granada. And my great passion is flamenco, and I started to learn flamenco and went to Spain in the 90s at least twice a year to different schools to try and see whether I could do it. I did it to a certain level, and I'm still doing it. But one of the points that I was trying to make is it gave me and opened my experience to a different culture, and Spanish people in general, and I think Mediterranean people more widely, have the ability to enjoy life much more easily than we do. Well, I should speak personally, I don't know about you, so you can tell me later. But they, in terms of the amount of time they have in the day, my friends and colleagues are researchers, and they have very busy lives, but they're able to actually take time to make sure that they live as well as work. And again, it relates to this work-life balance that I think is very much part of the asset model. But particularly, I see the asset model as more than something that can help us think about health. It can help us think about living. And so that's where I'm coming from. And I'm actually going to just dip into some of the slides that I've got here, just to plant some of the ideas. And I think I'd really like to stop at various points and see whether we can get, I know it's a little bit more difficult in this sort of situation, whether we can get some dialogue going. In terms of where we've got to, and my presentation is based on two publications. The first is the first article that Eri and I published in, it was Promotion and Education, but is now Global Health Promotion. And that's where we first set out a systematic framework for actually thinking about how we could build a better evidence base for assets-based approaches. And the reason why I wanted to do this was for my parallel experience of working in NICE, which is an organisation which probably most of you know. It is an independent organisation that's responsible for developing evidence-based guidance to promote best practice at a broader level. And as I said earlier, a lot of the things that I think we will be talking about in the next few minutes never really get into the evidence base that we see within committees. And I think that's one of the first challenges that I like to put out to you, is that how do we make sure that some of the knowledge that we already have lands on the committee that's thinking about how to make sure that a broader set of people are doing the things that we know work very well. We then went on to actually publish a book called Health Assets in a Global Context, because I was very much aware that actually even though we come up with this nice idea, a lot of the things were not necessarily new. And that's one of the things I'd like to say, is that actually what the asset model is trying to do is bring a whole range of different and existing ideas together in a systematic way so that we can utilise what's good about different concepts to think about positive approaches to health. So but there is a need to systemise it, and the need to think about theoretical perspectives, methodological, how do we evaluate these things, and what does action and effective action look like? And so we invited different authors who've been working in the field in order to actually at least illustrate different parts of the model. And that's available very expensively by Springer Publications. So that was something that just somebody asked me, was that actually when is it going to come out in paperback? So I'm going to pursue that one. So what I'll be talking about is actually I'll be trying to give you a narrative of my own experience, but very much in almost parallel streams, because I've got one side of me that's actually got a lot of experience in actually thinking about issues relating to develop evidence-based public health. And then this idea around the asset model, which is about really thinking about how we can look at positive ways of actually developing health programs. And then the challenge is, how do we bring those together? So I'm going to start by rehearsing some of my experience within NICE and and previous to that. I'll talk a little bit more about the key features of the asset model, and hopefully we can then get into a dialogue to try and hear from you about what you think about this, what you've been doing already. Because it's in terms of moving it on, we need to actually hear the experience of things that are already in place. That's it. There are three phases to this model, and I will talk about each of them separately, but just to give you an idea that this is the framework which talk about the ideas around the theoretical perspectives, what ideas, concepts are out there that help us think about positive approaches. Then there's the action phase, which is really the stuff that's talking about how to do community-based initiatives very well. And then some may argue that you shouldn't defeat the object of these types of approaches to evaluate. And of course, I would say I don't agree because I work in an evidence-based organisation, but we can have a debate about that. But before I start, there are a few caveats. It's not rocket science. You know a lot of these things already, and I'm very aware that I shouldn't be teaching my grandmother. Or my grandmother's, and no age reference there, to suck eggs. But actually, sometimes we're not very good at actually doing the things with what we know. And some of the things that I'll be talking about are basic acting as human beings. And one of the things that I'm very aware of is a lot of us, when we go to work and work in professional situations, forget that we're real people. And therefore, sometimes we actually lose our creativity by doing that, perhaps because we're framed by institutions and organisations that allow us to do that. But individual responsibility in those jobs, if you care about health and not just about the place that you work, it's our responsibility to actually bring some of the creativity that most of us have. Well, I would argue, in terms of assets thinking, that everybody has the potential to be creative into the workplace, even when you think it's difficult. Disappointingly, and again, when they said there's a lot of interest in your talk, I'm always very aware that actually you think there's a new publication out there, and I'm going to give you the answer to what works. But, you know, we all know that life is complex and it's not that simple. But again, what I'm trying to put over today is a way of thinking and working that allows us to apply the knowledge that we have, and there won't just be one solution. There'll be many different solutions depending on the communities that you're working with, and hopefully I'll give you the idea that it's about the solutions come from the community as co-producers of health rather than us as professionals doing something to them. And again, for those of you who've been around the block a few times, and I suppose I have, if I've worked in the NHS for 28 years, then you might say, you might be looking at all my slides and saying, well, I've been there, done that. And I think we all need to think about, well, yes, we have, but if we're continuing to work, are there ways in which we can revitalise energy in order to actually bring about change? And I think there's a moment of opportunity, certainly in Scotland. You've got the Chief Medical Officer who's into this approach, and therefore there is an opportunity to actually move it forward. But I know there can be a tendency for us when we've been around for a while to actually say, oh, not that old thing again, because we changed labels and, you know, we accused people of reinventing wheels. My argument is that it's all right to reinvent wheels if what you're doing is actually enabling something to move on. And sometimes I think the whole idea of health inequalities, which is the framework within which the assets model is based, sometimes I think we've got stuck. So the assets model is not a new thing. Remember what I've said, it's about bringing different things together, but actually thinking in a positive way. I don't think this square wheel will help this chap on the bike. So perhaps in that instance, reinventing the wheel is not a good idea, but sometimes it's useful. Reiterate this point because actually I really would encourage you to actually remember that you're a human being and that you all have needs. And actually part of the asset model is about maximising the opportunities that we all have while we're on this earth to have a good life, and that includes health and health outcomes, but it actually includes in making sure that we have opportunities to experience diverse experiences, whether that be within or outside of communities. And often, if you take it to the extreme, and I am talking stereotypes here, is that the nanny state, this poor child in bed, thinks there's nothing to live for, even at that early age. So think about it as an opportunity to think about how we make the most use of life. I picked this up off the internet the other day, and that's the beauty of the internet. You can get some, you know, knowledge is there for the taking. Don't know this chap, vocal coach and opera singer, and he's talking about knowing, doing and knowing, and whether there's a difference. I think we know a lot, but actually we're not always able, for whatever reason, to put it into practice. And so breaking some of these barriers up is part of what we're trying to do in the asset model. It's a useful thing to keep in your head, because one of the other key messages that I always give is that actually we're not trying to create necessarily new knowledge, but we are trying to use the knowledge that we have in the best way possible so it can promote health at its best. And again, lastly, the very basic premise and principle of the asset model is that I'm trying to encourage people to look at that glass half full as opposed to half empty. And it's more, sometimes it's more or less difficult depending on your personality type. And we talked last night, we're talking about nature and nurture, and Harry was saying that actually, it's mostly about the nurturing. But sometimes I think that the way that people's brains are made up makes it more difficult for them to actually think about that glass half full. I don't know how many glass half fulls there are in the room. Would you want another show of hands for that? Oh, that's good. Just to give you a definition before we move on. This is a broad definition, and we'll pick some of the things up in a minute, because a health asset can be defined as any factor which maximises the opportunities for individuals, local communities and populations to attain and maintain health and well-being. And a little bit more further development I've been doing with a colleague in Granada. We're trying to actually articulate the differences between assets for knowing and assets for doing, and it relates to different parts of the model, but I will say more about that in a while. So it's not just about community development. I think that's one key message I will give you, because it can be the idea of assets and protective factors can be operating at the individual level and the community level, and indeed individuals start off as individuals before they get into communities. So we've got to recognise the relationship between the individual and the community in order to think about how best to act. I'm going to skip these two slides. Sometimes I actually summarise my presentation before the end, just in case you've all dropped off and it is the end of the day. But sometimes it's useful to get the key messages out on the table. But in terms of the fact that I've got a lot of slides, we'll skip those. I just want to say a little bit more about my experience of working in the field of evidence-based public health. As I said, I've been with NICE 5 years, and prior to that, I've been, I think, the Health Education Authority, in fact, was one of the first organisations to commission a systematic review for health promotion, sort of jumping on the bandwagon of evidence-based medicine. But I was involved in that, and there are some interesting lessons to be learned. And I'm not going to go into great detail about NICE and organisation, because I'm maybe assumingly wrong, and a bit arrogantly wrong, is that I'm assuming you know a little bit about the organisation. So, but you can ask me questions about it at the end. But essentially, it's a guidance-producing organisation, and in public health so far, we've produced 36 pieces of guidance. across a wide range of public health topic areas, and some on areas which I would argue are cross-cutting, and I'll be talking a little bit about the community engagement guidance that we produced a couple of years ago. Of course, we're most well known for the technology appraisal program, you know, we're the organisation quoted in the Daily Mail as not giving the drugs that people need. And you might actually say that about public health. We don't need the evidence base, let's just get on with it. So there are, not everybody's signed up to the ideas. But the whole principles of NICE is to actually take on board some of the things that Archie Cochrane said back in 1979 when he started the evidence-based medicine process. And it's based on the idea that actually, in terms of resources available, we've actually got to make some assessment about what works and what doesn't work and whether they're cost-effective in terms of whether the benefit is greater than the inputs that are needed. And they're very, very sound principles. The key questions that we ask are what is effective, what is ineffective, what is harmful or dangerous. And often that doesn't come out of the scientific evidence, so we do need to think about evidence more broadly. The scientific evidence, and that from systematic reviews, often doesn't answer the how questions, and this is where I think assets-based approaches can help, because it doesn't get into the detail and the ingredients of what makes something successful or not. Increasingly, and I don't know how it is in Scotland, but in England, we're having to make the business case for public health. And as you know, if you've worked in public health for any length of time, very difficult to make the business case across short periods of time. And therefore, we've got to think more creatively about how we demonstrate the worth in the short, medium and long term. And I think that's one of the real benefits of NICE, that it does have the methods and processes to help us do that. Again, one of the really good things about NICE is not only the methods that we employ to synthesise and collect the evidence, but the process that we go through in order to actually translate that evidence into a set of recommendations that people can use. And there's a whole range of principles. And I'll just pick out one. And that is the idea of genuine consultation. At each stage in the development process, we put out our work onto websites so that stakeholders can have their say about whether they think we're right in terms of the key questions that we're asking, whether we've got hold of the right evidence, and importantly, what do they think are the barriers to implementation. And it really makes the process much more rich in terms of actually thinking about bringing different types of people together. So I think that's a very positive thing about the NICE NICE as an organisation. The legacy of Cochrane, and this is about the bit of the downside, obviously it's been going for around 30 years and perhaps 15 in public health and health promotion, is perhaps the overimportance of the systematic review. Even though these are the very things that we thought were going to give us the answers to understand what works. But it has made sure that actually we do need to think about evidence-based decisions. There are limited resources out there, and we need to make sure that the things that we want to do are effective and, importantly, are done well. And in terms of the public health programme, one of the broader frameworks is in the need to actually think about the evidence base in terms of reducing health inequalities, and not just what works generally, but what works for whom in different contexts, and whether there's issues of relative effectiveness depending on the population group that you're talking about. Now, I am a great supporter of the systematic review and the transparent systematic process that is involved in producing them. But given that I've been around the block a few times, my first systematic review, which was on substance misuse, we didn't replicate it, but we did a very similar piece of work on one of our first piece of guidance in NICE. And it was very clear in the 10 years that we were talking about, the evidence base and the research that was needed in order to actually get to the right questions had not moved on. So the gaps in research were actually almost identical to what had gone 10 years before. So there's got to be something wrong in terms of the way that we're collecting and collating knowledge. Part of it, I think, is systematic reviews, by their very nature, ask broad questions, and therefore we get broad answers. So I'm not dismissing them, because if I'm dismissing them, then I might be in danger of being out of my ear at NICE, because that's the main lifeblood of NICE. But in public health, we've tried to take a very broad view of the evidence base. And therefore, I'd like to impress on you, in terms of evidence, the Centre for Public Health Excellence in particular values all types of research, not privileging types of hierarchies of evidence, but it does maintain that actually the research that we use needs to be to demonstrate some form of quality. So keeping the principles of transparency, which is what evidence-based public health has been very good at, is a very important thing to remember. But one of the things that we're moving towards slowly but surely is starting with what decision that you want to make. And I think this idea can be very helpful in actually thinking about building an evidence base for assets-based approaches. Because what we do, we stand here and actually say, what are the effective approaches to reduce the misuse of alcohol? And it depends. But if you were more particular about what type of population are you talking about, which type of actually geographical region are you talking about, and taking account of culture and all the dimensions of health inequalities, you might be able to get to the evidence a bit differently and look in different places. But just to, I don't need to go through this, but just to reassure some of the doubters about the NICE process is that we do have the facility to build on scientific evidence to actually produce a set of recommendations and produce guidance that actually can be meaningful. We're moving on to, in terms of how this relates to the assets base, in terms of the evidence-based public health, I actually think even 10 years on, or 15 years on, the evidence base about how to reduce health inequalities is still very limited. And I think we're rich in description. Actually, we're very good at actually describing health inequalities, but we're weak on solution. Or are we? Because there's lots of good practice out there that allows us to think about how the sorts of things that work, but it's not documented. And that's part of my plea within the asset model, is to do more documentation. And I use precisely the word documentation because, you know, I could have used evaluation. Well, actually, at the very least, we need to document what we did, how we did it, and how we got to the place that we wanted to go to. And part of the reason why there's so many gaps is the gaps in the initial formulation of primary research. And again, that relates to getting more particular about the types of questions that we ask. And there is a gap between evidence and practice, and I think part of the assets approach can help develop the science of practice. And again, the knowledge is there, we just need to find a way of actually constructing it so that it can be held and it can be seen as credible against the evidence that comes from more traditional forms of science. But lastly and importantly, in terms of this presentation, one of the reasons why I think we have not got as far as we could have done in health inequalities is that there's been too much focus on a risk factor deficit approach rather than an asset-based and resource model approach. And therefore, that's the linkage between my work in NICE and the stuff that I've been doing with Aereo and with Harry and with others on actually trying to think about how we make this more systematic. So just to give you an idea of the differences between assets and deficits, deficit models tend to focus on identifying problems and needs of populations requiring professional resources, resulting in high levels of dependence on hospital and welfare services. That's a traditional way in which a lot of policy is developed. In contrast, asset models tend to accentuate positive ability, capability, and capacity, i.e. that when we're actually working with local communities, we don't assume that they have nothing. We try and start from where they're existing and try and, in the first instance, identify the skills and possibilities for them to actually be in charge of their own health. And again, this is the approach that's important rather than actually necessarily thinking about the asset model as a new concept that will be helpful. However, what I'm not saying is that I'm not saying that deficit approaches are not important, because in reality, they are. All I'm saying is that we need to redress the balance between the dominant deficit model and the less well-known and understood assets model. Because I think where most policy is focused is on the deficit side, and a lot of the work that's done in community-based initiatives does recognise strengths-based work. But again, and I will reiterate it because I really think it's important, is that we need to develop the knowledge base in such a way that it's seen as credible to a wider group of people. And that doesn't mean to say that we have to get reductionist about the knowledge, because we understand that the processes involved in working with populations and communities are complex things. But we can. There are methods available to deal with that. This is one barrier in terms of, and this is where I am stereotyping, is that it's difficult to actually engage in different types of approaches, because we work in organisations and frameworks whereby policymakers can't quite get the head around how you're going to measure progress, how long will it take? That seems a long time, 5 to 10 years to me. And in some instances, and I've got to be careful with Harry sitting in the room, because he's an example of somebody who can, but it's very difficult in those situations to deal with complexity. And that's because of the structures inhibit us thinking about ourselves as human beings, because we're very good as human beings, and when you're at home, thinking about complex lives and dealing with complex issues. But at a policy level, stereotypically, I said that we're not so good, and that can be a barrier to assets-based working. Just as an illustration of the need to do assets-based working and risk-focused strategies, is that I always put this slide up, is that actually I would argue that this man is a glass half full man, because he's actually taken the opportunity to have a barbecue while his house is burning down, but he still needs a fire engine. And you know, we're not so idealistic that we think that if we can all be assets-based and focused, everything will be all right on the night, because it clearly isn't for him. So I'm not trying to. I'm not so naive to think that. That's just a definition again. In terms of definition, it's very useful to actually distinguish, and this came out of also my thinking around the work that I've done on social capital for health, because actually social capital as a concept is much maligned, and particularly in academic circles, it's, you know, you're either pro or you're anti, and there's nowhere in between. But you know, thinking back to the riots that occurred during the summer of last year in England, there was lots of resourcefulness going on in the streets, and actually in terms of the looting that went on, but I would say that that's not an asset. Being resourceful in itself is not a key characteristic for the types of thing that we're talking about. But to try and distinguish between the types of questions that we need to ask, the asset-based approaches ask questions like, what makes us strong? What factors make us more resilient, more able to cope in times of stress? And what opens us to more fully experience life? And in the conversations I've had with Harry and with others, you know, Harry talks about connections, and actually how do we actually provide opportunities as professionals with people to have different types of connections. And we can discuss this in more detail, because giving people opportunities to flourish by experiencing different and diverse types of connections and networks, I would argue, makes them more resilient to deal with some of the stresses that they will inevitably face as they go throughout their life. As opposed to all the other questions that are important, we're not saying that those are important, but I would argue that some of the skills related to this side of the diagram can actually help alleviate some of those risk factors that we know a lot about. So just to go back to the model in terms of the first phase, I would argue that the first phase of the model is more related to a researcher, but it's actually trying to establish the initial evidence base to try and identify the key protective factors. What are the key protective factors that will allow us to maximise opportunities for good health and living. We already know a lot about those, but it's research that can actually try to help identify whether some assets are more important than others. And these, and at the moment I'm actually talking at a very individual level, but it's the sorts of things that allow us to actually put on the table when we're working with key communities in terms of the skills and competencies that allow us to the things that we're trying to attain. And that's what the first bit of the model is about. In the model, just for illustration, we focused on the idea of salutogenesis, which I'll talk a little bit more about in a minute, focused on social capital and focused on resilience. But there are many, many other concepts that have been around for a long time that might be helpful in actually thinking about the types of assets that can be protective for individual level health and indeed community level health. And again, the idea that I'd impress on you, what instead of at a research level, and I think it's the next slide actually. No, it's not. But it's coming up. Where is it? This is one for researchers. We did the policymakers. But in terms of that long list of concepts, and again, the wonderful internet, probably this is not evidence-based, but sometimes you just have to let your principles go, and actually it was a nice diagram anyway, but is that actually researchers spend a lot of time actually arguing amongst themselves about the whys and therefores of their particular concept. And in fact, if you examine any one of these concepts, they're overlapping, a lot of overlapping ideas. And you can relate them back to, you know, even the theory of Marx's theory of alienation. Some of the things that we're talking about in terms of community development relate to people's feeling of belongingness. And a lot of these are trying to tap into those protective factors. The reason why there's a long list there is because actually I think they can be useful if you're using an inclusive report to try and identify a candidate list of protective factors that might be useful in thinking about health and well-being. For those of you who don't know anything about salutogenesis, I should perhaps ask the question, how familiar are you with this idea? Which will give me an opportunity to have a glass of water. Not much, but... And I'm by no means an expert, but one of the things that we did in the book was to invite experts to talk a lot about this. The originator, author was Aaron Antonovsky, who described a lot of this work around salutogenesis back in the late 70s and even before that. But Bent Lindström, who's a Finnish researcher who also works in all over Scandinavia, has really taken the banner of salutogenesis and actually trying to make it operationalizable, if that's a word, within the health field. But the reason why we think it's very useful for the asset model is that it talks about health generation as opposed to disease pathogenesis and disease generation. So immediately it gives you the idea that actually we need to ask different questions. We need to pose the question about what do we need in order to generate the best possibilities for health. And it also asks questions like, what causes some to prosper and others to fail or become ill in similar situations? There are many examples that I'm sure that you have experience of where even some people living in very poor circumstances still manage to thrive. We don't often research or look at those sorts of things, and I think that there's an opportunity to identify the key sources of health by actually turning the wheel on its head. One of the key concepts behind salutogenesis is this idea of sense of coherence, which I'm drawn to because it goes beyond the idea of health, and the idea in a nutshell is that, and it is measurable, this is it's to give the idea of certain people with a high sense of coherence have an ability to understand the world they live in and to understand what is going on, and therefore can be more active participants in the health development process and to be able to thrive when things are not going so well. and they're able to manage life in a much more facilitated way by, and this part of this, I would argue, comes through having diverse life experiences. And I think it's a useful thing, perhaps as an alternative indicator to put in the assets box. And there's a whole lecture that you could have on that. And within the idea of salutogenesis, again, this idea of multiple concepts comes into play around what is needed to provide people with this the skills and competencies that allow them to have this sense of coherence. That's the slide that you've seen. Again, I'm not going to talk about social capital much, but it is one of the things that I know about. And one of the things, the reason why it was difficult for some people is that it could be seen as doing harm as well as good, you know, because social capital talks about strong reinforcing networks that can be important for health. But some networks are obviously useful for people to do things that aren't for the general public good. And that's the distinction that we'd make in the asset model, is that if you're going to think about networks, how can they be used in order to promote the best possibilities for individuals and for others, and the relationship between individuals and communities in order to promote their own health and well-being and create the health in communities. Again, another lecture, but that's just to one of the reasons why we've focused on it. It does tap into the idea of connectedness. And if you look at the underlying constructs of social capital, I don't think people can argue as well about that rather than the overarching idea. Sometimes the word capital is a little alarmist for some people when you're putting the two together. Resilience is another thing. Social capital, for example, I would argue is an example of a key health asset. And it's something that perhaps comes before the idea of sense of coherence, and it's something that we can build the capacity of individuals to be working together for themselves, but also for others. So I think it has potential, but I don't actually care what you call it, as long as you bring it back to the root idea, and that is about social connectedness and social networks and the ideas of positive social networks. Resilience. There's a chapter in the book on this, and resilience has been identified and as another health asset. And what we're starting to try and do is actually trying to understand the interrelationships between these key ideas, because we know a lot about the ideas themselves, but we don't know how they interrelate. And actually, that's important for thinking about process and mechanisms to try and bring about health and well-being. Again, one of the problems is that a lot of these concepts are actually quite complex, and that can be quite off-putting, particularly for a policymaker, because often it's easier to deal with smoking and some of the other, more well-known risk factor public health topics, is because you can count it. This stuff is a little more difficult to count, and therefore, in the idea of resilience, you are starting to ask policymakers and those who might be giving you money to take a few risks. And that's why, in terms I'll come on in a minute, is we need to think about differently about the types of evidence that we need to convince those who are investing in these programs that it's a good idea. Now, this is a chapter by my boss who talks about life worlds. And again, this increases the complexity. I'm not going to go into this in detail, but his main thing is the idea of life worlds, and the life world and life course together are the bridge between the social structure and individual biology. And he sees the need to actually understand the interrelationships between individuals, communities, and social structures, organisations, and the fabric of our societies. But he says if we can do that, then you can more easily identify the types of assets that can be protective of health. And I'm going to skip that because that's more of the same. So there is a job, and one of the things that I did as part of my PhD thesis work is actually trying to understand the concepts. And I think that in the main is the work of researchers, but being fed by the experience of practitioners who can actually add something to the meaning of these things in real life, because often we start to continue to overdevelop these things and we lose the meaning in terms of we increase our knowledge about it, but actually how do we apply that? And actually sometimes we have enough knowledge to actually just go ahead and actually use it. But it is and can be useful for actually thinking about a different set of evidence for indicators for asset-based working. Another key message that I'd like to give you is that whilst we're trying to, through research and those concepts that I've mentioned, identify perhaps a key set of candidate assets, it's not a one-size-fits-all. And one of the other principles of the assets approach is to take a life course approach. Now, one idea is that the more people can accumulate assets as they grow through the key stages, the more likely they are to be able to manage life's difficulties and things that may block them from progressing to the next stage. But in terms of thinking about what people need and working with communities, this will differ, you know, in adolescence as it will when people get older. So that's something to hang on to in terms of what we need when. And actually, in terms of working, and just to illustrate that point, one idea and one premise that I'm giving is that actually the earlier we start, you know, certainly early on in life and early interventions is very seen as very popular in policy circles, is where we need to be starting, is that then the more chances you're giving people to maintain their health and to have a good life. But there are some circumstances where, you know, people get into trouble, and we have to think about how we apply the assets approach to, in this instance, for thinking what types of assets do offenders need in order to get take a different path and get them right back right on the path. So again, thinking about how you apply the approach rather than actually just sort of saying, well, if you give them a dose of this and these are some key assets, everything will be all right. It's about working with people as well as identifying the key skills and competencies and experiences that will help them do well. I've got a particular focus on adolescent health. Often it's a stage in the life course which is forgotten, that, you know, particularly some professors of the early intervention approach, is that actually if you get it right in those early years, the 0 to 5, you don't have to worry about them. But again, things are changing, and this is a very difficult period for young people. And we need to think differently about how we engage with young people, because this is the sort, I mean, it's back in 2008, but it could be 2012. You know, we think that all young people are getting into mischief, when in fact, I don't know whether you mentioned the health behaviour school age children, Harry, in the introduction, but I'm the principal investigator for England on this European study that collects data on adolescents in about 40 countries now. And most children are satisfied with their lives, perceive their health to be good, and do not regularly suffer from health complaints. So what is about these children that allows them to actually get on and do well? We don't often research them, and you know, one of the pushes in the assets-based framework is to learn more about the things that are going well rather than necessarily always thinking about actually understanding how we change the things that are not going so well. And that's a premise that I've put up already. Again, this is an illustration of that we already know a lot, and let's build on that. This is a list of development assets that's been prepared by the Search Institute that identify the key skills and competencies that young people need as they're growing up. What we need to do is actually identify how these things are interacting. What are the antecedents, and actually what are the consequences of investing in some of these assets? And the overall idea is that, you know, if you concentrate and refocus your energies into assets and positive ways of thinking, there will be less risk-taking behaviour. I don't think we've got an awful lot of evidence to demonstrate that that's necessarily the case, but it's one of the premises that actually I think would be a useful thing to demonstrate. Because many of the things that are characterised as assets cut across all the topic-based areas of public health that we often develop in terms of policy programs, whether it be smoking, alcohol, obesity levels. But some of the social skills that young people require can cut across these things, and therefore we can be being more efficient with the way that we develop our program activity. Overall, though, the essence is it's about increasing assets and reducing risk, understanding that there will always be risks, and indeed some risks are very useful to develop the resilience that is helpful to thrive in difficult such situations. And now perhaps the idea that people are most familiar with is assets-based working in the community. And the second phase is the action model. And it's the types of things that a lot of the practitioners in the room will be involved in. And this is where we widen the definition. This is where we start talking about assets for doing. If you remember, I talked about the difference between assets for knowing and assets for doing. When we're thinking about assets for knowing, we're trying to identify those key assets that might be protective. In this instance, we're thinking beyond the individual and thinking about how we can use the assets of local people, local institutions, and local organisations in order to address certain issues that have been identified as important for the local communities. And therefore, it widens the taxonomy of the idea of assets. So you had to have one for the community worker or stroke practitioner, but this is often the idea of a stereotypical practitioner for the researcher or the policymaker is that, you know, they don't want to be interfered with. They just want to be able to get on with it, but they do need more money. And I think now I've got all those out on the table, one of the messages that I think is key to making the assets model a success or not is how do we work together across policy research and practice. We don't often do it well, although I've heard some examples in Scotland this morning where there are opportunities to do it in your country, perhaps more easily than it is in England. But often, because there is a need for a researcher who's so wedded to one concept that they actually drill down until they understand everything. But there is a need, I would argue, for a different type of person who can work across the piece, who understands the issues and perspectives of practice-based working, but also has an eye for research and maybe has got some experience of what it's like for a policymaker sitting there having to actually think about actually acting very quickly and getting results. And it's those sorts of people that perhaps can actually help provide the glue to us working more effectively together, because we need to learn from one another and we can't do it alone. Community engagement. NICE, National Institute for Health and Clinical Excellence, although when we went into NICE, they didn't actually recognise the health in the acronym because it would have spoiled it, is that we did guidance on community engagement, something that I never dreamt that we would ever do in NICE. And it's been a very popular piece of work. And it demonstrates that you actually are able to draw on a wider range of evidence to actually think about how you develop a set of guidance which actually says, we all know that involving local communities in the health development process is worthwhile and is a value that's littered in all policy strategies, but how do we do it well and how do we avoid harming communities? And I think to some extent this guidance actually achieved that by actually building on impact evidence, but also actually taking care to actually include process evaluations which help us to understand the mechanisms about how different people work together. And also we did a review of lay perspectives and on their views about what it's like to be involved. Included in this guidance is this idea of this ladder of involvement, and you might have seen something similar. It's not, you know, there are different variations on the theme. But the idea in terms of community assets is obviously, I would argue, that community engagement within the assets context is very much based within the sort of upper echelons of this ladder, i.e. that one of the aims is to start the process of actually sharing power with local communities. However, there might be circumstances when all you can do in terms of the resources that you have available is to have one one-off consultations in a community setting that actually tries to get some ideas of what the community thinks. As long as you're actually upfront and you are open in your communication about levels of expectation, I think that's okay. But again, and this is one of the issues I'm thinking of when I'm saying that it's not rocket science, it's about treating the community as though they're real people and they're not something that you just do things to. And that's about having good communication and leadership skills and bringing the most out of them. One of the things that we've got in the book is the work by John McKnight, who's done a lot of work with the idea of asset mapping, which I know seems to be going on a lot in Scotland, but it's actually helping us with a tool that helps us to think about how we learn to ask what communities have to offer rather than their deficits, and to try and identify and make explicit the knowledge and skills and capacities. And the essence is to actually build the trust between professionals and the local community, and that's a process that can take some time. This is just a list of the types of assets, so I don't need to go through them, but as I was saying, it moves beyond the individual in trying to say, how do you use local recreational centres, how do you use formal institutions to create spaces for communities to live, work and play, and how do you work together to try and actually perhaps overcome some of the power struggles that local community members feel when they're actually dealing with professionals working in organisations. And the idea of assets map, again, you can tell me whether you're familiar with these things, is actually just not looking about what you haven't got, but actually looking at the potential for all these different things, the churches, businesses, local institutions, schools, in order to come and create solutions for issues that have been identified within the community. So the process of developing an assets type framework within the model used by John McKnight is, first of all, you create a vision, because it's not just enough to actually identify that, you know, the local school can be an asset or a local business can be an asset. What for? What is it that these can offer? What are the characteristics of a health promoting school or business that allows you to get done what you want to get done? And so there is a need to actually create your division, map the assets that are potentially available, and then connect the assets for productive purposes. I'm sort of coming to the end now, but actually one of the things that has been a theme running through my thoughts on the asset model is this notion of individual and community. I argued at the start that actually I don't think it's just about community development, but I actually do think it's about equipping individuals with the sorts of skills and competencies that allow them to work in geographically bound communities, but allows them to actually look for, search for, find opportunities within a diverse set of networks, sometimes which might be outside of the community. And we can have a conversation about that. I'll leave that one for the discussion. So we've got to have a set of values that equips the individual, but has a set of values where people a first port of call is to actually think about when they live in a particular area, they have a responsibility to making that the best possible place that they can live, but not just for them, but for the people who also live there too. I don't know in terms of politics whether that is conflicting or whether it's possible to marry the two, but it does link to some of the work on social capital, which talks about bridging and bonding social capital. But the optimum would be to have both things, you know, an individual and the community. Evaluation. Got one slide on this, but actually I'm not going to go into it in detail. But I think in NICE we've demonstrated, in public health at least, that it is possible to take a multi-method approach to evaluation that tries to get into not understanding what works, but how things work in different contexts. And the methods are already there. What I've got on this slide you already know about, but it's how to utilise them. And I think about thinking about starting with the question that you want answered and being more precise about that, and working back what sometimes I call an evidence scenario. So thinking about the man who's just coming out of jail and needs to get back on the right track. How do you approach that person? and the sorts of assets that might be important to him, and what evaluation techniques can you use to demonstrate that you're having some effect. So the methods are already there. It's just that we need to think creatively about how best to use them. And in the book as well, there is also evidence. I talked about it's important to document things, but there's an example of a German project which actually used an assets-based methodology to try and increase opportunities for migrant women to undertake more physical activity. And within the chapter in the book, but it's also published in Social Science and Medicine, which I think is great, it's actually a real good example of how qualitative work and combining methodological approaches can actually produce an evidence base to try and understand the types of things that need to happen to redress some of the power struggles that you can often see between local communities and officials. So, you know, you can get access to that in Social Science and Medicine if the book's too expensive. What next for assets? I think we already know a lot. We need to accumulate the experience that's already in this room, that's already in other places, because actually we all tend to do it in our own patches and underestimate the power it can have if we bring it all together. There does have to be a willingness. I've also argued that we need to change mindsets. Is it too much too soon for, you know, your stereotypical policymaker? I don't know. I think this man in the front might be an exception, you know, because it's more complex and people have to take risks, I think, a little bit. But from my own perspective, and I would say this, wouldn't I, because I work in NICE, I still think that we need to engage in the evidence-based approach to thinking about demonstrating success. So we do need that evidence. Many of the assets acting as protective factors cut across risk behaviours. So that's, I think, an important notion to hang on to, because there are potential savings to be had if we actually think about looking horizontally rather than actually developing programmes that are necessarily all the time working in silos. And actually, a lot of the protective factors that I've talked about relate to the social context of people's lives and therefore have the opportunities to contribute to reductions in health inequalities. And one of the things that I've noticed in the 32, 36 pieces of public health guidance that we produced is many of the things that we're recommending are very similar across different topic areas. There's something about that that makes me think we're missing a trick. We produce all these different publications, but there's another publication to be had about the critical success factors for whatever you're working in, whatever topic area, connecting people, individuals and communities is something that can actually make the difference between success or failure. I've talked about this, so I won't go into it in any detail, but there's a further level of research that I think is important to do in trying to identify whether some assets are more important than others. You saw within the young people's example that we're very good at actually determining the importance of different assets and producing long lists of them, but we need to think about how these things interact in order to make it more more real to real life. These are the key features of the asset model that I don't need to rehearse in a presentation, because I feel as though I've talked about them in depth. But it's about thinking positive, about thinking about the life course approach. Involving people in all aspects of the health development process is ultimately what we're talking about, to engage them and to recognise what they have and what they don't have. But also inequalities, the social context of people's lives, I think some of the answers to building those core competencies for living are the key assets for health and well-being. But the challenge is, how do we reconstruct the existing knowledge that we have? Because we do have a lot of knowledge to make a difference. And I think if there was not work to be done, we'd all be all right, but there's still work to be done, so we have to think about that more carefully. Challenges for policymakers, I think you've got the message by now, but we all need to think differently about the way we work. And it's not necessarily new, but sometimes being creative and actually taking a different approach. There are new people coming on stream that haven't heard any of this, So there's you know, we've got to keep the energy levels up, and being creative is one way of doing that. And recognizing people's strengths is paramount. And basically, that's what I'm talking about. A picture of some young people because of my work on the HBSC study. But I'm thinking more broadly than health, but I'm thinking about the asset model can help us think about having positive lives and positive futures. So I'll stop there and you can say whether you agree or not.